And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight we have a very interesting story. And I'm really looking forward to talking with Jerry this evening. But we have Jerry Wenstrom, and it is called The Inspired Heart, which is a book he wrote. And he has done some very interesting things that most people probably wouldn't do. I'm just adjusting the mics here because we're getting too much. Okay, we're good now. Okay, so welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Lori.
And hopefully we can get this a bit louder. Okay, so let's talk about, usually when we start a show, we start with the journey of how you kind of got here. But your whole book, The Inspired Heart, is really your journey.
Yes. Yes, I wrote the book in a certain way, you know, because we can write about anything in telling our story. But it was about the stories, the moments where inspiration carried my life to the next level. I mean, having given everything I owned away and deciding to trust reality just as it was without interfering, it was a difficult way to try and exist. And so whenever I came up against my limitations and fear, there were just these moments that were either going to carry me over or leave me there. And the stories in the book and the nature of the book is defining those moments, because I think they're universal, and it's the thing people find useful in their own struggle.
I would definitely agree with you there. We certainly tend to, as you did, sort of, I think we have different ages that we may go through our journey, but I don't know that I've ever known anyone to have gone through quite the death of the ego that you did. I mean, you really let go of absolutely everything that you were to, and you know, it was really about, you know, surrendering everything and every part of who you are, and it was to find God.
Yes, and you know, what I find is that in a lot of ways, to look at my story, it's, I think people tend to think that, you know, it's more difficult than anyone else may have done, or people wouldn't choose to do it. But what I find in working with individuals is that there are so many of us going through it in our own way. And I will admit that I was a willing participant, which is probably the unusual aspect. But in terms of the letting go and the metaphoric death process, so many of us are going through it at this time. In fact, we're going through it as a country. So what I see that it doesn't matter that you happen to be the one who chose to do it, if you want to call it a choice. What matters is that you fully traverse the territory of your own loss, whatever that loss is, even if it's simply the loss of your joy in life doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I guess that would be, I mean, I think, you know, this is a time when a lot of people are experiencing that kind of pain or that kind of fear, and it is an exciting time as well, but it certainly, again, I'm not sure that I've ever known anybody to go to this extent, but I agree with what you're saying. I certainly, you know, around the age of 29, went through my own similar experience, and I think I've gone through about three more lifetimes since then, at least it feels that way. Where, you know, we go through all of these, and there's layers to letting go that you kind of really took it upon yourself to really embrace.
Well, you know, I also think, and this is always one of those tricky things to talk about, but I really do believe it's true. There's such a thing as a kind of holy retirement, you might say, where, you know, yes, the cycles come around and it feels like we're going through a kind of death over and over again, which is at some level true. But also, you know, it's in all traditions, but in Christian theology, they talk about until you die and are reborn, you don't experience eternity, eternal life. Well, that's in all traditions, and basically eternity is like a promise. It's like when we've really walked into our death and really let the gods know we mean business, one good time, where we just really deal with what we've been handled, with what we've been given, and fully, you know, inhabit that loss and inhabit that new ground that we are given, what comes through is like a promise. It's not like we have to save ourselves again and again. It's more like at the moment in the cycle, and the cycle is like cycles of the moon, when we experience loss again or when we experience that metaphoric death again, what comes through is the memory of how to die again. And it comes through gloriously. It comes through like renewal. I mean, instead of avoiding it, which most of us do, and we don't necessarily succeed at that because it broadsides us, what we do is we find renewal in the scariest places of our lives, and there's no greater gift. That is eternity. Eternity is when we are faced with metaphoric death, and I believe in literal, even literal death. When we are faced with it, to be able to turn that into life is eternity.
Hmm. Yeah, well said. You had a lot of people that... that you wrote about that seemed to have a significant place in your own healing as well as theirs. And I, you know, there's a lot of people, so I won't go through all of them, but I think there was sort of it seemed that there was a pattern between the divine feminine that seemed to rescue you, or there seemed to be instances where the divine feminine sort of came through and assisted you, and also you had a lot of experiences with children, and I think, you know, the kids these days, and have been for quite a while, are pretty special, but they were able to recognize, and I think the women as well were able to recognize the depth of where, you know, you were, and certainly led you out of some interesting experiences.
Well, yes, you know, Yogananda talks about aspects of God. He talks about God the Father and God the Mother.
Mm-hmm.
And God the Father demands a kind of perfection that's impossible. You know, it's the place where we need to apply our discipline and our effort and our will and put everything we have into the creation of the most beautiful life possible. And we will fail. And that's where God the Mother comes in. Yogananda describes God the Mother as loving us no matter what. So I think what always saves all of us is the divine feminine. It's never the Father. The Father is ruthless. But I think we need that balance. You know, we can't just get wishy-washy either and just, you know, sort of contemplate our navel for the rest of our life and think that's all there is to life. I mean, it takes enormous effort and everything we have. And in fact, Ramakrishna, when he was pestered about how to find God with this one particular follower, he finally sticks his head under the water, and when the man came up gasping for air, he says, "When you want God as badly as you wanted air, you'll find God." So I think there's God the Father. There's that necessary, you know, effort that needs to be put forth, and we will fail.
Mm. Well, there was an experience with Callie as well, and I don't know, she's not necessarily the easiest of the goddesses to connect with either.
No. It's interesting you should mention, I just finished a new art piece. You know, I do these three-dimensional life-size figure sculptures that are very coffin-like, and on the outside there's a carved figure that's the feminine, the representing the virgin, mm-hmm. innocence, and the sweet side of the feminine. And that figure opens like a door in a huge 7-foot-long hollowed-out cedar log. Inside, there's a carved figure of Kali. So it's different aspects of the feminine. I call it feminine balance. But in producing the inner figure, and, you know, it takes months to carve these. They're life-size figures. And if anyone wants to see, those mm-hmm. images are on our website at handsofalchemy.com while we're talking.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was carving the Kali figure, when it was done, I got a call to find out that my younger brother was dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, when Kali's in there, it's very often serious business at some level. But I think the gift of even Kali is to say that's a part of life. You know, to be able to, I think when you see the mystery that comes through, at moments like that, for me, it just lets me know that all is well. You know, even though this is a difficult thing, even though it's a sad thing, there's a perfection to it when you feel like, you know, the universe knows what's going on. You feel it's connected to everything else, and so you're able to handle it in a way that you wouldn't if it all seemed meaningless.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the part that you were able to get to, that grace from letting everything go. But not a lot of people understand that. There's a lot of people that get very frustrated when we say that everything's in divine order, and, you know, people came in wanting to experience certain things and choosing, you know, to experience certain things, and, you know, that whole balance of karma and the interplay that we all are a part of, a lot of people find that very, in some sense, they should find it very empowering, because we have complete responsibility, if that's the word, or freedom in how we can let this go instead of worrying about it. But in other senses, they, you know, get very frustrated and aren't in that place of that surrender or seeing that grace.
Yes, well, it's not like being frustrated or not wanting to go there is going to make it all go away. I think, you know, what you find out is that you have to be present with every kind of a situation, with all experience. There's at some level, it's all part of the dance. And, you know, in God's mm-hmm. eyes, it's all exactly as it needs to be. So, I mean, if I could have avoided, if I can avoid now the difficult challenges in my life, believe me, I would do it. But I don't see that there's any way through it but right down the middle. And I think, you know, to stay present with what is going on and to trust it. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen many of the experiences that I have. But when they come, I think, you know, I have a personal mantra, and that is, this too is God. So when I'm faced with something I would rather run away from, I turn into it with that mantra, this too is God. I mean, and to approach it like that, it's the shortest distance from point to point, which is, you know, from the place of fear and limitation to the place of renewal and courage.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good mantra. It's a great mantra. You did a lot of healing. You also were able to heal the bloodline, where you went recognized the karma of your father, and, you know, and of your mother, and how that sort of interplayed in your life. And I think, you know, a lot of times we need to understand and look at the patterns and how they sort of play out in our lives, and take that time to sort of really, I guess, I mean, at the end, you learn compassion and forgiveness. And I think a lot of times people get caught up in wanting to blame, you know, all their problems on their family or someone else, and taking that responsibility becomes a bit of a challenge.
Yes, and it is for all of us. I mean, because the weight of the family shadow, and every family has a shadow, I don't care how perfect we think our upbringing. I love what Robert Bly says about, beware of the man who thinks he had a happy childhood. Well, and I think, you know, we all come through with a family shadow, and at some level, the healing process, you know, the story that you're talking about in the book, that healing process, it was so much an epiphany and so much a gift, of, again, of the feminine, in that it was a moment of grace where everything made sense. So I think, you know, as much as we think we can do, and we have to do everything in our power to try and be as conscious and live as beautifully and as we can, But we can, you know, we can also get trapped by the family shadow by reacting to it, mm-hmm. by saying, I'm not going to be like mother who was so difficult or father who was so difficult. And in that, our life is not our own because our reference point is father or mother. So in some way, that too becomes a holy purpose. I mean, it becomes a kind of prayerful, conscious presence that you hold around the difficulty and you tend it in a way that looks for moments of grace and synchronicity rather than thinking at some level you have to save yourself. Because what I discovered is that, you know, you can't get there from here. I don't feel like I healed the bloodline. I feel I gave myself so completely to the process that there was a healing. And that story in the book is pretty bizarre and pretty, you know, it's, but it was a complete epiphany, and it completely liberated me from that shadow, so much so that I was able and am continuing to be able to be within the family system and stay clear and also help others. And I think that's the freedom and the gift of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we tend to get caught up in the reactions and not really be as aware as possible of you know, why we're getting caught up or what, you know, why we're reacting in the sense that, you know, I think our parents are often our greatest gift and certainly our biggest mirror in helping us remember what our buttons are. I don't know many people that can go home and spend any time, significant time with their parents and not, you know, have some sort of buttons being pushed.
Yes, and I mean, ultimately, to know we're just all bozos on the bus, and in some way, you know, I think as difficult as our parents may be, you know, they have done their best. They inherited the shadow from their parents.
Of course.
And, you know, they don't even know that they're passing it along. So ultimately, to find our own liberation in that shadow mm-hmm. is to be able, as you say, forgive and also be of service to them. I mean, if you really could see for one little moment that what looks like your parents pushing your buttons is really their fear and their limitation and, you know, they're behaving in the way that they don't necessarily even want to, I think you can serve that moment with compassion and effectiveness because of that, you know, healthy distance from it. Mm-hmm. My wife has these Native American teachers, and one of the things they say about is the most important work any of us can do on the planet is heal the bloodline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see where that would be huge.
Well, if you look at it, most of what's going on in the world is unresolved issues that we've came through and very directly related to our family. I mean, look at even the Bush administration in relation to his own father trying to prove something, getting into a war. I mean, it's all family. You know, there's bloodline stuff that makes a mess of things. I mean, not just personally, but collectively.
Hmm. Yeah. And how do we learn to live out of fear?
Outside of fear?
Outside, yeah, outside of it. Especially in a time like this when there's so much that's being hyped in the media. I mean, I know what my answer is, which is a news fast, but I'm not sure everybody else is there yet.
Well, I think you can't necessarily do, if we're looking at the larger collective fear, it's overwhelming and there's not much we can do about it. Mm. I think what we have to do is deal with our immediate personal fears, like, oh, I'm afraid of heights, I'm afraid of water, or whatever it is we're afraid of. I'm afraid of being mugged in a city. Or I think being in each moment as it comes up, what we find is that fear is actually a great opportunity for liberation. And the only way through it is to fully inhabit the fear. You can't make it go away. You can't avoid it. You can't buffer yourself from it, or your life will get very small.
Hmm.
So to fully be present with our individual, lonely little fears, I think what you ultimately discover is that there's incredible joy and possibility right behind them, hiding right behind them. If we can get through, if we give ourselves, if we become the fear so completely, then only thing we can do is run for cover. But if we really fully traverse each moment of fear as it comes and get the gift at the other end, what you realize is that fear is actually one of your best allies. Because, again, Marilyn's teachers say where there's fear, there's power. And so you're able to tap the power. Once you've done that, there's still big, scary things in the world, and they're very difficult for all of us to carry, collectively and personally. But what happens is that, and again, it gets back to that eternity that I spoke of earlier, what happens is that you know there is no death, because ultimately fear is fear of death. It's fear of being consumed by forces larger than our own. And I think when you find life in that moment that feels like death, you will always find it. And even though you don't know how to find it, you know it's there and you will approach it differently. And so that's your freedom. That's the only way to deal with a big, scary world, is to deal with personal fear and to find the gift that's hidden there. Then you'll know it's all a gift.
Mm.
But you can't fake that. I mean, it has to be a reality that you know in your bones. I mean, there are moments when something will scare me, and all of a sudden I'll catch myself, and it almost goes by like a strange bird, and I say, what was that? I mean, I feel it in my body, or I notice it, and I turn to it more quickly than I turn to a joyful moment, because mm-hmm. the joyful moments are easy. It's the moments that are creeping up on me that are looking like something that I'm avoiding that are much more important to deal with. And I think that's what we can do. When you deal with the, it's almost like money. You know, they say if you deal with the pennies, the dollars take care of themselves. Similarly, if you take care of your small fears, the large fears take care of themselves because they're all the same.
Hmm. Yeah. So while you were doing this, you went through a great deal of doubt. Yet you still held this faith and this courage. What was it about this? Like, what was kind of your turning point? What sort of created the transition back to life?
Well, I never would have been able to live. I lived for 15 years without money, hardly mm-hmm. touching money, just trusting reality as it came. So you know, there's no way I could have done that, because I have doubts and I still have doubts. That's part of being a human being. But what carries my life isn't the absence of doubt. It's the ability or the moments that where doubt doesn't matter anymore, because you see that there's something larger that carries you over that limited place. That's what I was saying earlier about what my book's about. There are moments when we come up against every limitation. This is the scariest, most difficult moment possible for me right here and now. And there's not a damn thing I can do about it. And to be in that kind of a situation and to walk forward through it anyway with a kind of trust and faith, and then to have it all delivered in a way that is larger than you. And it's really like a quantum leap. It's a moment of grace. You know, you can't get from here to here on your own, but by staying present with the fear, with the limitation, the gift comes through and gets you over to the other side. When you see that that happens, you can no longer be, you know, avoid that moment. So I wouldn't have been able to live the way I have for so many years if I didn't see those moments. I couldn't have done it. I didn't have enough will. I didn't have enough intelligence. I didn't have enough good intentions. I didn't have enough of anything to carry such a long, strange life and make it work out in the end. It was those moments of grace, that quantum leap, that I realized in moments of limitation and nowhere else, not in joyful moments. I wasn't so happy that I could just do this happy life. It's more like these things that scared me to death offered incredible gifts and liberation, and that's what gave me confidence, the fact that it worked.
So each time you knew that you were being, you know, supported in the hands of God, you knew that this is why you were doing it?
I don't know if it's this is why. I don't think there was any kind of a deal like that. It's more like life is meaningless if it's not meaningful. I mean, there's either a God of everything or there's a God of nothing. and I needed to find that out. I mean, it seemed mm-hmm. meaningless to live a half life based on fear and, you know, the creation of security and buffers against our limitations. That kind of life made no sense, and it makes no sense. I mean, a meaningful life that unfolds in a way that's larger than our puny little ideas of how reality should be, I mean, that is the most alluring of all possibilities. I mean, we're on the planet for a very short while. It's not like we're going to beat physical death. So it's like, what else do we have to do? I mean, we're going to live a puny little frightened life and make ourselves all safe just so we can die in a more expensive mattress? I mean, like, what's the point? But the point where meaning comes in is that you find meaning even in death. I mean, like Peter Pan on the little island saying, what a great adventure death is going to be. I think even physical death will offer that liberation. And who knows? But I can't believe, from everything that has looked and felt like death to me, since it has delivered such an incredible gift and liberation, I can't believe that's not going to be the end game. And also, I mean, that's what most Tibetan practice is about. I mean, the Dalai Lama says he works on his death every day for a certain amount of time, because in a lot of ways, that's life. You know, it's like to be able to keep yourself free from that and to befriend that scary territory for ourselves is liberation.
Hmm. Yeah. Were there moments when before you gave everything up that you were, you know, experiencing this? I'm not sure what
I was a very driven painter in the studio, right. And creativity is very similar to what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and we're creative. I mean, if you look at any creative venture, and it doesn't have to be painting like it was for me, but, you know, raising children or even creating a business, whatever we do that requires our creative sensibility, if you look at the rhythm of creation in a certain way, you know, you come up against, say for me being a painter, I would be able to paint my status quo on the next painting, and it would be as good as the last, but nothing new, and I would feel really stuck there. It wouldn't mm-hmm. go anywhere. And if I stayed there, the world would have said, well, that's a good painting. But to break through, I'm going to have to take a risk. And so to break through that limitation and smallness that I feel fixed on, and to be able to break through, you take that risk. And in taking it, inspiration comes through. And inspiration is like always a wild card. It always comes in a way that you didn't expect. It could look like a mistake. It could just be a different quirky idea. Something new comes through that takes you to a whole new level. And it's a very similar process. I mean, that's sort of the rhythm that is in all things.
Hmm. Wow. So at some point on your journey, you decided to completely move, and that was sort of your coming back. I know that there was a point where, you know, you had you'd given your gloves away, and then you ended up going to the dump, and you sort of, it seems to me that almost foreshadowed what ended up happening, which is where you find your art expression these days, or at least at one point in your in your book, that was when you would get your inspirations for art, which is kind of an interesting way of going about things. But, and then that sort of brought you back, or at least that was sort of a turning point for you.
Yes. Well, I mean, and it's not so different from what we're talking about. I mean, we all have our junk in life, you know, that which no one wants, experience that no one wants, fear that no one wants to have to deal with, look at. And like the jewels you find and create with, I think that's the, excuse me, that's the raw material of our lives. You know, it's the, you know, whatever comes is grist for the mill. And I think, you know, that, a very good metaphor to turn junk into beauty, into creation.
Mm-hmm. So then you moved completely to a different side of the of your country, and you kind of again let go and sort of trusted that this is what, you know, you wanted to do, or you listened from within, and you started to, you know, started to trust the unknown, formless spiritual path that you were on.
Yes, moving to the Northwest, and, you know, its circumstances all line that up to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the book you read about the nuns giving me this purse full of money, and that's how I got here. But coming to the Northwest, I now live on Whidbey Island, Washington, was like a return to the world. You know, in many ways, leaving the world, I mean, I didn't even talk for a year. I gave everything. I just kept giving it up, and And you know, part of me was always resistant of that. You know, I loved the world. I loved life. I wanted to be in the swim with every other normal human being. But I kept feeling like this is what the path requires, and I stayed with it, and the magic carried it, so I stayed on board with it. And it was as if the moment I finally quit resisting and says, I can do this emptiness. You know, I can do this, and I will do this. It was as if the moment I said that, the gods upped the ante, and they said, okay, back to the world. And moving to the Northwest really was that for me. I began speaking publicly. I got involved with what then was called the Chinook Learning Center, which is now the Whidbey Institute. And, you know, I was asked to write a book. There was a film that Parabola magazine made about my life called In the Hands of Alchemy, which is now with Sentient Publication. But all these things were putting me back into the world. And one of the most terrifying things was opening up to relationship, because I had been celibate for 15 years. And here all of a sudden, I was feeling like it's cowardly not to explore the energies. For several years, I just explored the energy of sexuality and relationship without being fully engaged. And then finally getting married, which was ultimately, I say this because it sounds so unromantic, but actually I think it's the best way to get there. It was almost as if it didn't matter at all. There was nothing I wanted. And it was to just simply look up one day and know that here I am. This is what I am now. And I think, you know, all of that was sheer terror, because it took so long to leave the world, and it was so difficult. And so finally, when I got comfortable, going back seemed like a whole new struggle that I'd have to deal with. And in fact, it was, but it was, I have to say, much more joyful struggle, because it made sense. I mean, at least the world can understand being involved in ways that, you know, that deals with, you know, normal things in life. I mean, and now I'm doing things like, I actually have an event scheduled in New York in a couple weeks with the author Vicki Robin, who wrote Your Money or Your Life, and we're working with 40 corporate executives from some of the major corporations in the country, talking about resourcefulness. You know, Vicki will talk logically about what to do with your money to get your life back, how to simplify and do things, and I'm there to talk about what to do when even your money fails, and how to find, you know, creative possibility in nothing at all. So we're going in as a team. I mean, if you think about that, A Life is Strange is mine to be at some level serving corporate America is almost bizarre, but it makes complete sense. That's part of returning to the world, is that you go into the desert, you find your gift, you find the thing you need for life. And I think there's something truly called the zeitgeist, which is, you know, in any of us, and many of us who have been saying yes to life, who are at all sensitive to what's coming through the collective, we're often the first to go, in a sense. We're the first to, at some level, be asked to give ourselves to this inevitable process that's coming through for all of us. And when we have found the gold of that process, the world is following suit. I mean, I feel now, with what's going on in the country, with the economy, everything else, my life was completely set up to be in the service of this huge loss we're all feeling. And I feel I can do it joyfully. And I know I'm not alone in that, because I know how many people I've been dealing with over the years who went through it in their own way. So it's a collective shift. And to have given ourselves to it early is to be at the celebratory place now when all is being lost. You know, Lao Tzu says, and this goes for all of us, Lao Tzu says, when the world is up, the sage is down. And when the sage is down, the world is up. And if you think about it, if we're tending our own soul journey, when the world is celebrating, riding high on our great big economic bubble, and you know, thinking the world is our oyster, and we're not a part of all of that, it feels very, it's a kind of very lonely business. But if we tend the soul work that's coming through, that's necessary for everyone, and you know, I think some of us are better at avoiding it for a little longer. But then when it comes through, we are actually in the best position possible, because we're bringing through what is so essential for the rest of the world. And, you know, at some level, we're all in this together. We all have to serve the process. It's not like any of us can live selfishly. And it's really wonderful to have the richness of soul experience to be able to bring to the world when things like financial powers are failing. Is that the end of the world? No, it's not the end of the world. Here we are. So let's make something new out of this. It's just another new possibility that's completely necessary, because the planet would not survive doing it the way we were doing it.
Right. And that's really the bottom line, isn't it? Is that we've been heading towards this for a long time. It's just a matter of it catching up with us, and now it's here.
Just like our big debt bubble, you know, it's the same thing. We owe the earth. We have to pay the earth back, and it's now is the time.
Now is the time, definitely. Now I see that the dates, and I know that you didn't know whether this was significant or not, but I mean, it seemed that it was around 1987 when you moved, which is the harmonic convergence, which, you know, it seemed to be an important shift in the planet at that time, that the spirituality was starting to build. And I do think that was probably very significant in everything that was going on around you.
Yes, and I, you know, being part of the Chinook community, it was certainly a kind of big celebrated event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't say, I'm more interested in, I see things like that, how my life is in, you know, corresponds to things and moments like that in relation to larger shifts or whatever, people who define larger shifts. I'm not someone who can do that, but I do see that, oh, I'm exactly where I need to be, which is, again, another form of divine encouragement I feel. You just feel, you know, you're in the best seat in the house of your own life, which is, you know, you can feel good about that. But I wasn't too caught up in all of that, you know. I didn't give it too much importance. I was living the shift as it happened, and that's more what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you sort of talked a little bit about, you know, the collective consciousness and how the shift that's going on right now seems to be quite significant, and I think I would agree, and I think, you know, it sort of has been building since that time, and has building and building and building, and whether it's building towards 2012 or whether it's, you know, just us as a whole, you know, starting to wake up more and become more consciously part of the collective consciousness. I do think that we're going through, you know, quite a lot, and I love how you talk about the magic in the world. Because that's one of my words that I like to use. And, you know, we need to recapture the magic. We need to remember what that was like when we were, you know, younger and knew that magic existed.
Well, and the good news is it's the only way to survive right now, so we can't avoid the magic. You know, I often use a quote that the gods whisper before they scream. I think the gods have been whispering what we're going through all along, and if we have been listening, we are fully with exactly what is. And I think, you know, and that makes life, for the most part, a lot more sensible. You know, we're already in a position. But I think the scream, that what is going on in our country now is a very gross form, and it will get more grotesque. There's no question about it. Because some of us don't change until the pain becomes unbearable, and that's what we need to create for ourselves. It's not necessary, but I think many of us choose that. We avoid the work long enough that the whispering gods become screaming demons, and it really looks and feels like that. You know, people die, wars happen, the earth rattles us off the, you know, off the platelets, and you know, things start to happen that tells us to wake up in a very loud voice. And I think that is part of what always happens. And I think we can choose ourselves how much we are being willing participants in the necessary changes of the time. And the magic comes with the subtlety of listening, with the courageous, quiet moments between us and our God, us and our moment of fear, whatever it we're faced with. That's where the magic is. And if we can find the magic in the little things, you'll find them in the larger things. Large shifts like we're going through, it becomes just the exact same process. It's just a big screaming demon rather than a quiet little demon that's sort of, you know, pecking at our conscience.
And I like how you talk. I mean, soul work is what we're doing. And, you know, you talk about enlightenment, that it's no longer reserved for the mystics, but it's now required.
Yes, that is true. That is true. I think, and that's where I said the magic is a requirement now. Because logic, that's part of why I'm doing this corporate thing. Because, you know, money's not working for these guys. Logic isn't working. So what do you depend on? Is it the end of the world? You know, so I think, yes, we're all required. That's the new level we're forced to look at. Okay, I can't control the world. I can't control reality. I can't control nature and the weather and the global warming or whatever else is going on. What can I give myself to that is fruitful and alive and creative? And there's the magic. It's always here. It has never gone anywhere. It just changes form and waits for us. It never disappears.
Yeah. So then you entered into a relationship, and you talk a little bit about how, you know, any true seeker on a spiritual path needs to go into the challenge of what the garden is like, which is your sexuality, because I think, you know, we all, and I believe it, and I think there's a lot of people, and it's a very dark area for a lot of people, that there's a lot of trauma and a lot of abuse, and it's just an area that a lot of addiction, and we need to, you know, really embrace what it means to be in a relationship and to have that kind of connection that is extraordinarily powerful.
Yes, I mean, it's the, you know, next to a direct experience of God, I think sexuality is the next probably more powerful energy. You know, it's the physical form of it. And that's why so many of us get so damaged in it or get so hooked by it or get so lost in it, is because it's nearly impossible to handle. But, you know, so is everything else. And I think, I know for me, and it's not a moral issue. I mean, I think morality can actually get in the way of healthy exploration. Mm-hmm. I think it has to be approached with absolute respect and absolute courage. And it's like you live it like a canary in a coal mine. You go and you walk into the energies, and you don't sell yourself out, or you don't take what's not yours. And I think that's more how the exploration works. You know, for me, like I said, I was involved in a tantric way for a couple of years, just in the energetics of it. And it had nothing to do with anything but finding out where I could go and what I could do and where I could be in that energy and stay in the place of freedom and health and not get hooked by it or be afraid of it. Because, you know, coming out of those years of celibacy, it could also be, you know, that could be a reason. Part of me didn't want to go there because I had finally, you know, come to terms with my emptiness, and now here I was having to, at some level, it felt like having to explore this territory. But I think it makes for balance. Nothing can be left undone. And I think in many ways the sexual energy had to wait until the very end because it is so powerful. I mean, that's why it had to happen at the place it did. It made complete sense that exploration would happen at that particular juncture.
But there are a lot of mystics that, you know, still maintain celibacy. There are very few enlightened beings that we know of that are in healthy, harmonious relationships. And yet that's where we grow the most.
Yeah, I think everyone's path is individual. You know, it's like, you know, they say there are saints who don't eat. They live in air. And I mean, true. I think, you know, there's, Lao Tzu says, the Tao denies nothing to no one. And there are traditions that that demand certain, they have certain requirements. It's part of a tradition, and traditions that are alive and well are, there's a kind of miracle that carries the structure of them. And I think that's why if we, whatever religion we get involved with, if we really give ourselves to it in the most powerful, innocent way, that it's as good as any other, because the structures that are holy are held and they actually do work. So I think those who stay in celibacy are people who have given themselves to a form. You see, I was a formless explorer.
Right.
I had no religion. I mean, mm-hmm. I studied them all, and I saw an essential something in all of them that I just saw no reason to go to any particular one. So my journey makes complete sense, but I know that if I had given myself, say, to the priesthood or to a tradition that requires celibacy, I know that the gift of that position would have been given. Mm-hmm. And even for me, I felt like I didn't have what it took to maintain celibacy in the way that I was in some way in my head. If I were just in my head around it, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But because, again, just like how did I eat or how did I do anything else, it was that moment of miracle that really held it in place for as long as it did. And so, you know, it's like everything else. There's a way structures are held if that's our path. So it's not like one is any better than the other. I mean, to just be celibate and think you're going to live a holy life is bizarre. You'll never pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah. I think these times that it's a matter of really embracing all of who we are. And, you know, we have such a richness of emotions that we, you know, have available to us that we, you know, we tend not to explore the richness of it. And I think we're coming into a time when I think relationships are going to become extraordinarily important and very important on our spiritual journey.
Yeah, and they always have been important. Mm. But, you know, some people are so seeped in relationship and sexuality that their challenge is to let it all go for a while. You know, again, it's an individual path. I think, generally speaking, there is a wholeness being required of all of us, and that wholeness can only happen by the merging of masculine and feminine energies. But, you know, that can happen all by ourselves and alone, which, in fact, to pull off any healthy relationship, one has to find that aspect of allurement within themselves and come to terms with that and not expect someone else to carry it for a relationship to survive. So even with relationships, when you boil it down, it's still about self. It's still about creating that relationship with those aspects of yourself. And, you know, like I said about finally getting married, I could only do it when it didn't matter anymore, because I already had the marriage within myself, and so I could do it with another human being. And that's not to say it's not difficult at times or it's not challenges, but the same death that goes in the cycles of everything else goes in the cycles of relationship. And if you know how to do the death and find renewal, that's what saves a relationship. It's what Robert Bly calls the third body of a relationship. You know, it's not you or them, it's that third body that holds the relationship. And that's what is nourished by that renewal in death, is the third body. Mm-hmm. So like everything else, what holds it together is the miracle, mm-hmm. the inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Let's talk about the inspired heart.
Okay.
As in, you know, you kind of got to the part where, you know, you now are re-embracing your art as a spiritual path. And, you know, you talk about the inspired heart as, you know, you've surrendered into the hands of this and... we talk about a lot of stuff in that chapter, but if we surrender into the hands of a success larger than our own, the God that fails may in fact hold the seed of our success. So failing is not a failure, in that we also succeed if we trust our original God and innocent intention. So it's about, you know, really And I think the inspired heart is really about, you know, going within or finding that surrendering, that part of ourselves where we don't try to control and dominate and manipulate, and we can allow our ego to die and that aspect.
Yes, well, like you say, there's a, you know, in all traditions, there's a kind of holy defeat that is prerequisite to liberation. And, you know, in other words, we all set out, especially as young people, thinking the world is our oyster and we can do what's never been done. And we come up against that kind of holy defeat. And we can either die there and get discouraged and, you know, like the biblical story about the person who's given the money and says, well, I know what's going to happen, so I buried my money and I didn't invest it. And, you know, we can do that with our lives at the point of defeat. But defeat is written in. It's Christ in the garden. It's Buddha at the verge of enlightenment, where he was either going to get enlightened or die. I mean, there's holy defeat. You can't get there now. You can't do anything more. You've given your all and you have failed. You can't do it. That thing you created that looked like the perfect family and the perfect job is all coming undone. It's all a big failure. What do you do there? I think if you lived your life consciously tending the best you could, then the defeat is part of the journey. It's part, you know, Yogananda says, to set out on any holy purpose, which our lives are, and to die along the way is to succeed. So in the defeat is our success. It's, again, back to that quantum leap or that renewal. Or in Christianity, it's resurrection. Or in Buddha, it's with the Buddhists, it's the enlightenment. I mean, it all, the dying part is all written into that holy defeat. And it can come in many ways. I mean, I know people who lived like fools and died and found themselves more than they did in their lives. So literally dying was the best thing that ever happened to them, because they were living recklessly and horribly, and they became incredibly beautiful in their death. So, I mean, it can be literal, or we can do it right here and now with the death of our economy or the loss of a job or the, you know, or whatever it is, our loss of our investments, however things are being undone for us, that might be the holy defeat for us. And it often hits us in the place of our false God. I know for me, as a young artist, I mean, I would literally say the one thing I will always do is paint. And so the gods kind of said, oh, yeah, that's the one thing you're going to have to give up. And I think that's the way it is. You know, what is the one thing? Is it your children? Is it your relationship? And, you know, it's not about necessarily giving it up for its own sake, but it will be challenged. And if you can't put it on the altar with a willingness to let it go forever, then it will not be returned to you sanctified. A thing is sanctified in sacrifice means to be, make sacred. When we can sacrifice that which we love the most, that is made sacred and given back to us. I mean, it's like me and my art. I was willing to give it up, and I thought I would never go back to it. Trusting the soul work of it more than just the addiction to, you know, creation or whatever I thought my identity was as an artist. And because that willingness, it was given back. And I became more known as an artist for destroying the work than I ever did for creating it, which is part of how the paradox of resurrection works. You think it's death and it's life.
And I guess the gift that you received is that you no longer separate your art and your life. They're all one universal, interconnected circle.
Yes, well put. That's exactly the difference right there. You know, the way you get out of bed in the morning, the way the phone call that comes, the thing you find on the street, the bag lady that screams in your face, it all speaks to some larger mystery that takes expression in the world. If you're an artist by way of an artist, if you're a mother by the way of inspiration to your children, somehow it all makes a kind of larger sense that feeds the whole.
And the way to get there is to become the holy fool?
Well, in that, you know, the fool doesn't take themselves too seriously. And part of the defeat, I mean, what makes it so difficult? I mean, I've worked with so many different people. And I have to say, I have a friend who's a millionaire. I mean, he's succeeded at everything. He's had the best jobs. He's a brilliant, brilliant person. I mean, that's just the nature of his life. He has been a winner at every front. And the one thing he couldn't do was stop winning, which ended up being his defeat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the holy fool, because we, when the whole world tells us what how great we are at everything we do, and we feel the power of that position, it's pretty hard to be a holy fool, because you take yourself very seriously. You start to believe what everybody's telling you, that you can do what's never been done. And so the holy fool is one who comes to life with the innocence of a child. You know, they're able to inhabit unknowing. A person who only knows success can't not know. They can't not succeed. They can't not have what they want when they want it. And there's no greater obstacle to our awakening than that kind of arrogance. And you know, even, however brilliant, however successful.
Mm-hmm. And again, we talk about the mystery, bringing the magic and the charm into our lives. And it's really that, you know, how that mystery and magic, and that's really the child, and that really is the fool. And I'm someone who comes from working with the tarot as symbology as well. So the fool, you know, that is the journey that we take. It's the journey of the fool. So I really resonate with and understand what you're talking about. And there was mention in the near the end of the book about, you know, we really resonate with our soul with the happily ever after, that's what, you know, that's kind of what we're looking for. That's kind of what our soul is, you know, looking for.
And it's our birthright, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think the difference as we grow older is that, you know, the fool innocence is naive, which means it's like a child. I mean, as beautiful as children are, as open and present with each moment as children are, they are incredibly vulnerable. You know, that mystery, that magic is not their own, and they will lose it. I mean, that's part of the Christ story, taking the child on his lap, saying, you know, this is going to disappear, basically. And so to make that, I think as we grow in our spirituality, in our consciousness, in whatever you want to call it, in our development, what happens is innocence becomes a conscious, applied science in a certain level. We cultivate divine innocence, which is conscious innocence, and then it becomes our own. We give ourselves to vulnerability, to unknowing, to all the things that the naive fool just, you know, lives out unconsciously. We live out consciously, and that's the difference from one end of the spectrum to the other. We start out perfectly beautiful like the fool, and if we're lucky, we can fully inhabit the territory and make it our own, and then live it consciously and powerful with a will of steel as well, with everything intact. That's what makes for a powerful life.
And the last, you say that the ego tries to survive, which is very true, and it is where it is our hearts where all is well, and that we are to find the beauty in our journey.
I had a little trouble hearing that.
Oh, sorry. You talked about how the ego is trying to survive, and that's certainly true, and that really it's the heart is where all is well, and that we are to find the beauty in our journey.
Yes, I mean, the ego's like a seagull. Ellen Watts called the seagull, I think, flying desire. I mean, there's no satiating the ego. It's just always looking for advantage and survival and, you know, ways to avoid difficulties and fear, and it's just a screaming, clamoring voice in all of our heads. So, you know, it does take the heart. I mean, if you go to the heart, when we are thrown back to our innocence by way of a bad experience or by way of just meditation or whatever it takes for us to let go of that screaming ego voice, I think that's what leads gladly. That's what guides our life in the way that's most possible. I mean, the ego often gets what it wants, but it's never satisfying, and it's very destructive to give it. Again, I mean, I think as a country, you know, the material side is the ego. I mean, if you look at the most destructive element in our country, it's the flagrant ego of a nation that just thinks it can have and take everything from anyone and have all that it wants, and it's just not the nature of reality. It has never existed on Earth before for very long. Why do we think we can keep it going?
Hear, hear. Well, Jerry, it has been a great pleasure to interview you. I'm thinking that I will try and book Marilyn on as well and see if we can't have another show with Marilyn. But it's been a great pleasure. I truly enjoyed reading the book. I think everybody should travel down that journey of just reading it allows us to recognize our own journey, maybe have some gratitude in our lives and assist us to work towards where we truly, our heart is leading us. So I thank you.
Well, thank you, Lori.
Why don't you tell people, I know you sort of mentioned it at one point, how people can get a hold of you.
Well, our website is handsofalchemy.com, and there's lots of artwork, our schedule, and, you know, a lot going on for both of us. And I could give you my email, which is also on the website, Soluna, like sun and moon, S-O-L-U-N-A, at whidbey.com. And Whidbey is spelled W-H-I-D-B-E-Y.com. And the rest of the information is on the website.
Perfect. All right. Well, again, it's been a great pleasure, and I hope you enjoyed.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So take care. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye.